your other films?
Yeah, we did a lot of actual physical work, about 2 months of it, actually, just to get the size, because in the book, as you'll read if you haven't read it before, Bud's the largest man in the Los Angeles Police Department. And I kept calling Curtis and saying, Curtis, you got the wrong guy, okay? You're kind of like, it's a trick of mirrors or something. Anyway, so he said, don't worry about it, and we didn't worry about it. But, of course, he's not cut or ripped because his diet and what he would be eating and the fact that he couldn't give that much of a shit about that sort of thing anyway. I mean, he's just strong and big. He's like an archetypal 1950s guy when he was getting the right amount of iron from his spinach.
Well, it's not the first time for you to be in that whole 50s milieu either with Rough Magic.
Yeah, yeah.
You wear those clothes well. I mean, you're in that time now, you know?
Well, it's for me, as an actor, there was like about 3 years in between those two films. And there's about a light year in the difference of the quality of the movie, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, I mean, you know, I've been there before, but this is kind of a much more urban reality for the character.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about accents. Tell us about the dialogue coaching you must have had to go.
Well, I've actually got smart about it. I used to think I could do it by myself, but film's a very difficult medium in terms of dialect and playing with accents and stuff. Cause it's not like stage. When you get on stage, you're there in the moment, you're rolling, there's nothing to sort of stop, you know, or interrupt you. But with film, you can be sitting around for 16 hours to do a couple of very key sentences, you know. So I learned from Nicole Kidman, actually, just to have a dialect coach, concentrate solely on the internal life of the character, and, you know, once, twice a day or whatever, you know, you just have a little conversation with the dialect coach about, you know, vowels and such, and you just go ahead and do it, you know. But what it means is that you're not kind of bogging yourself down in keeping all the accent information. You leave that responsibility to somebody else's brain, you know. And the thing is what happens is you actually, because you're not thinking about it, it comes so much easier, you know. If you've done, of course, the preparation work to start with, if you, you know, have spent the weeks and hours actually going over things and discovering the words that would be said differently in that particular geographical location, if you've done all that, then later on you just have somebody go, give you a little bit of a nudge every now and then.
Could you slide right into it now?
I could slide right into lots of different accents right now. I'm not sure if I could give you Bud exactly because, you know, that's it's all got to do with the time and place and the stuff. But I can go all over the place in terms of accents.
Are you flattening vowels? Are you,
with Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Well, it's like learning another language. Like if you're going on a holiday somewhere, you know, and you get out your French tapes, you know. Je m'appelle Janine. Who the hell is Janine? I don't know. Janine and Jean Clooney, I want to meet these two people. But it's the same as doing that. You know, certain words in certain areas will actually give you the key in for whole passages of speech, you know. Like in L.A. Confidential, one of the main examples, and this is kind of really cool because we did it in the movie, and this is the sort of level of detail that Curtis likes you to work at, is the scene with David Strathern, you know, playing Pierce Patchett, whose character comes from the East Coast. He says to me about Lynn Bracken, would you like her address? And I say, no, I've got her address. It's in the same scene, two American characters speaking from different sides of the country.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And Curtis came up to me that day and said, you know, Russell, I think we're doing something wrong there. And I said, well, how do you say it? And he says it the same as Bud because he comes from the same coast. So he said, oh, that's great. Oh, yeah.
Is there such a thing?
That's my only Curtis impersonation I'm going to do. And I'm not allowed to tell him I did it.
We'll quote him. You say anything you want. Are you, is there such a thing as an American attitude, too, in the way you carry yourself?
I think that has a lot to do with Bud being the cop that he is, you know. I mean, he's a nightmare, right? If you've ever ever stopped by a policeman, it's not Bud White that you want to be stopped by, is it? I mean, seriously, you think about it, it's like you couldn't get away with anything, you know. Once you actually came into his gaze, forget about it, as they say. Yeah.
James Ellroy left hipster messages on your tape.
Yeah.
What would he say?
You can't. You're not going to be able to print any of it. But for your own edification and enjoyment. Woof woof! Hear the demon dog bark. He's got a 12-inch wanger and it glows in the dark. You can just say I started with that, and he'll continue it for you. Believe me, when he comes in, talk to himself.
Do you think that your character is Ellroy? You were in My Dark Places. Are you familiar with this? Mm-hmm. Do you think your character is sort of shades of his real life?
Well, I think James's journey is very interesting. You know, he was kind of, you know, at a level of, if I can use the word, unfocused depravity, I suppose, at one point in time. But then he found something to focus on. He found a love. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with this theory necessarily, but I know it's something that people talk about. And Bud's journey is very similar to that, because he has this, like, huge level of aggression and a lot of problems to get out. But when he finds love, you see, it's in my imagination, if you project past the end of the story, Bud will probably never need to be violent or pick up a gun or anything for the rest of his life. Well, it comes out of people in different ways, doesn't it? And Ellroy in James, if we were going to use this kind of analogy, came out in a range of perversities, from taking prescription drugs to sniffing women's panties. In Bud, it comes out in a totally different way. You know.
Plus, he probably has a tendency to be a wife beater or a woman beater himself.
Who's that?
Bud. Because he comes from, and then at one point, you know.
Well, I mean, that is like an understood pattern of behavior that we know of now, you know. But I think it took, in the movie you see that situation arise with him, and it's not anything that he is proud of, relishes, would step towards, lean towards. He's just not that sort of person. But he knows that it lurks within him, and I think that's what most people are sort of... well, symbolic. If we can't smoke, we can have the ashtray. hold on, where were we there? Wind that back.
Talking about wife.
I mean, I think, you know, from a genetic point of view, if you know there is like some skeleton in your closet, then genetically, then you work very hard on keeping that thing in the closet, you know. And I think Bud knows that he absolutely knows that he has an inbuilt ability for huge violence, you know. But he doesn't necessarily like that part of himself. Everybody else compliments on him, but for him, it's just a tool. Like the next guy is, you know, smart with numbers or good with words, you know.
Did you sustain physical injuries on
his head? Like the odd muscle strain and stuff, but, you know, nothing... You know, I was pretty physically prepared for it. I was pressing 220, and for me, that's a lot. But you should ask Guy about that, though. he didn't get any injuries at all. But you know, I just that thing of throwing around the room like that. I mean, he might look kind of, you know, smaller of frame and slight, but Guy is very strong. Mm-hmm. He was. Oh, I won't tell you exactly what. He's been using his muscles from a very young age, and it takes a guy with great physical strength to be thrown around the room like that, seriously, and not have any problems.
Yeah.
When he goes into that cabinet, that's a wacko, isn't it? Straight out of the table. Wow, smack. Ooh.
You were raised in Australia. You had a lot of tough guys there, haven't you? I mean,
yeah.
Bud White would be more common occurrence there, or?
No, not necessarily. No.
What about policemen there?
Depends which state you're in, just like here.
Just don't go south.
No. Here it's don't go north. Don't go to Queensland.
Oh, okay.
Queensland's the Texas of Australia.
Where are you living now, by the way?
I live in the bush in Australia. Right now, at the moment, my girlfriend's band is on tour through California, so I hang in there. It's called THC. It stands for Techno Hardcore.
Ooh. Most of us have only the vaguest idea of what the bush is.
Yeah, what is
for
the
you, what is it?
well, it's that very obvious dividing line between the city and the outback.
And are there still Aboriginals there, or is it like America where they've been herded up and put away?
Well, we all come from the same kind of colonial burn and rule kind of situation. So, but you know, just as here, there's, you know, lots of places where people live and work, and you know, everything's fine and dandy. But in my direct area where I live, because it's sort of semi-coastal, that was the first place that the British went in.
Are you going to be one of the few Australian actors or filmmakers of some stripe or another who will stay in Australia as opposed to
I think it's very healthy, you know. I think the thing that brings a fresh voice to what I do is the fact that I don't necessarily live in Los Angeles, and I'm not, you know, 100% all the time doing that kind of highly competitive scratch and brawl, you know, that they do in that town. But it's not that I don't have anything against Los Angeles. It's the thing that freaks people out. It's like, it's there, it's the way it is, you know, but it just happens to be the center of the business that I'm in, you know, and there's a lot more wittier and clever people who can come up with some great lines for you about Hollywood and everything. But, you know, if you don't know there's bullshit artists there, you're a fool, you know. But what you got to do is you just got to keep going through those bullshit artists until you find yourself the true artists. And they are there because it's the center of the film industry, you know. And the greatest artists who work in film that are alive today get their money to finance those movies out of Los Angeles.
What was American cinema for you growing up? Indeed, what is it?
Earthquake. Sense Around. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Duh, that was big. But, you know, I used to go to, like, the 11 o'clock sessions of Papillon and things like that because if I went at night time, they'd question my age. But, you know, I saw a lot of Steve McQueen movies, like Junior Bonner.
How old are you?
33.
Oh, yeah. Does it dominate, though, the screens there? I mean, can you go to see Australian movies, or is it mostly American?
You can go to see Australian movies if the American distributors allow you to. No, I'm just joking. Australia's, it's just like here. I mean, you have, you know, cinema from around the world is available to you. You know, it's just dependent on your tastes and what you want to do. Obviously, the multiplexes and stuff are filled with the studio fare, you know. But we have a great company in Australia, actually, called Village Roadshow, and specifically a man called Alan Finney, who is responsible for bringing you Death in Brunswick and Proof and Romper Stomper and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Muriel's Wedding, you know, and just recently a movie called The Castle. He has built up over the years since the late 60s, you know, a trust between the audience, you know, and with the cinema distributors, you know, and every now and then you can make a domestic product into a huge hit, you know. The people want to support Australian films, you know, but it's got to be commensurate with quality.
Speaking of Australian films, what do you think, Some of Us was brilliant, it was a lovely film, it was a very sweet film.
Thank you, that's another one, Alan's.
That was one of his. And Guy Was in
Priscilla. Oh, actually, no, it wasn't.
Guy Was in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, mm-hmm. That was another Australian film. What do you think it was that Curtis saw in two Australian actors playing Los Angeles police officers? Not just that, but, you know, you played many characters, and you think he looked at those and saw...
looked at those and thought, ah!
LA Cops.
That's the way I see LA Cops. Look, I don't know. As far as I know, Curtis had only seen the one film, which was Romper Stomper. And this is something you should bring up with him, obviously you will. With Guy, I don't think he'd seen any stuff at all. So Guy got the gig purely off his audition.
Do you find people trying to get you to change your accent? American?
Not so much anymore, but I used to have that all the time.
Doesn't it help to have assumed an American accent for this? I mean, if you had to, you could, right? If you had to do it for some kind of a part, or Americans have a tendency to want to import
people I've proven
and turn
that.
Them into.
I think I've proven that now like six times that it's not really that big a deal. It's just like in the theater, you know. You take on a role. I mean, part of that role is the specific geographic location that this person comes from. It's no big deal. But, I mean, I used to have producers say, you know, Russell, really, you should walk in the room for the audition just talking in an American accent. Don't confuse the director. Don't confuse him. He doesn't need that. Like, if he's that stupid, I don't want to work with him, you know?
Of the L.A. location work, were there lots of examples of don't move over there because we have a sign absolutely, behind you yeah. that reads Nidus.
Curtis will probably tell you some nightmare stories about that, but, you know, sometimes I look at that, like, I mean, the street, the last shot there outside the City Hall, mm-hmm. you go and have a look at what that street looks like. It does not look like that. There's wires crisscrossing that thing.
Yeah.
You know, so they've taken that shot, you know, and they took hours, I think, of footage of it, and then they get out the old CGI pencil. They start rubbing things out, you know, or take out this crosswalk or take out these power lines, you know.
On the other hand, there are corners of L.A. that look like the Formosa Cafe. It looked mm-hmm. like
yeah, if you
they
go,
never changed.
If you go like that, it's
don't
perfect.
Don't look around it, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Formosa is one great example, and the Crossroads of the World is still there, but it's not lit up like it is in the movie, so they had to kind of find out how it used to be colored and stuff and what the neon lights were there and put them all back
when you
in.
Were a kid watching Steve McQueen movies, I mean, did you want to be, quote-unquote, a movie star? Was that?
No, it never really entered my head.
How did you become an actor? What made you want to become one?
Well, acting is different from being a movie star.
Well, that was right the next question.
Right from being a young kid, I always yeah. wanted to be a performer. It just took me, you know, 20-odd years to find out what the medium was going to be, you know. I worked a lot in music, and it took somebody making a really big mistake when I was about 26 and actually saying you should be in this movie mm-hmm. for me to do a movie. And then after I did it, I thought, well, hey, wow.
But what happens is when you give a great performance, and I think everybody's going to say you did, you get on the road to becoming a movie star. And sometimes people get away
but
from it.
But I think, you know, I think I'm pretty well grounded in what I do. So, and in fact, you know, I very almost exclusively now work in feature films. So, you know, if you're just talking pure definition, I already do what you're talking about. But, you know, I'm pretty grounded in performance. I did my first TV thing when I was 6. I've done like 2,000 live performances in the theater. I perform with my band whenever I can between films because it just clears the air performance-wise, you know. And it's also my responsibility. If I walk out and do a show with the band, then everybody's good time in that room. We got the one with
ice machine or something.
Marimba.
it's your responsibility, and it's totally different from being an actor on a movie set where, you know, it's kind of hurry up and wait, you know.
What kind of music do you do?
Let's not worry about it. Let's not put any emphasis on the music at all.
Well,
it's purely
curious.
It's purely
rock and roll?
No, it's just something that I go and do.
What instrument do you play?
The fool.
The fool?
Yes, and I play it very well.
I just got that. I'm sorry.
Would the more musicians have that kind of attitude? Given the current mood,
I thought that was an Australian term.
I think the public can respond to seeing a tabloid ad being beaten to death. Did you enjoy doing it?
He wasn't beaten to death.
Wasn't he?
No, he was beat. I beat him up. But I don't know how he got killed, but he had a pretty big, nasty hole in the side of his head here.
He shot him.
Oh, with a blunt instrument. Yeah.
Shot him.
Oh, you might be right. Okay. I'll have to watch the movie again, damn it.
What's a celebrity press like in Australia? Some people say that that's where all the
fans. I don't really want to go into any of that, if that's okay. Cool.
Do people still call you the new Mel Gibson?
No, just recently it was the new Nick Nolte. And then the other day it was the new Bob Mitchum, and actually I kind of like that one. I like all that stuff shit, except I kind of like that one. I was laughing about that with, you know, I don't mean to be rude about saying that. It's just purely a respect thing. Okay. We're laughing that, me and my agent, yesterday. We've got a whole page. It kind of runs the gamut from Clark Gable to Nick Nolte, so it's kind of funny, really.
I'm surprised Mickey Rourke hasn't been
brought up. The Mickey Rourke was brought up, and that was just recently, too. Yeah, it's unfortunate, isn't it?
Well, the young Mickey Rourke has.
The young Mickey Rourke was pretty damn cool, man. He was
rocking.
Yeah.
How much of your life now has been devoted to this film in post production with all of
these A long time.
Give
we us
some parameters.
We came back in for the initial ADR sessions in late January this year. You know, this is on top of the fact we, from March 5th to September 5th was the direct production period last year. Came back in to Los Angeles, part partway through January, towards the end of January, for 6 weeks. Came back into Los Angeles at the beginning of May, and this is notwithstanding all the telephone conversations as well. From May, went to Cannes, then back to LA to start doing long lead press, and have been doing LA Confidential specific things week in, week out, until we sit here now. So it's been a big deal. It hasn't been that big a deal on any other film that I've ever done, actually.
And on the whole,
except maybe Rumpelstiltskin, because that kept getting released in different places around the world. But after a couple of countries, I then kind of left it to the director. But here we are at the beginning of the release of this, and we've already been talking about it for probably 12 months.
And are you thinking, good heavens, will it be like this every time out of the gate, or I hope it will be like this every time out of the gate?
Well, you always hope that the things that you pick to do live up to their potentials, and I think that's why we're spending a lot of time talking about this one, because it's lived up to its potential. Actually, I think it's exceeded its potential.
What are you working on now, and what's coming on?
I haven't got time to work on anything now. I'm doing LA Confidential shit.
Doesn't sound like it.
No, I've read maybe 60, 70 scripts or something since the beginning of this year.
So you're going to work in the U.S.
No, I did a film in Australia straight after LA Confidential. It's called Heaven's Burning. It's screening tonight, actually. If you've got anything else to do, like washing your underwear and stuff, I'd do that, though.
Oh, jeez.
It's okay. It's really, it's kind of okay. I saw it as a much more heavy political statement when I read the script. It's by Louis Naur, the guy that wrote Cozzy. It's another Australian movie. And it's kind of been converted a little bit to a road movie, big red kind of schlucky road film.
Oh, geez. What's take on James Ellroy? What do you think he's like?
I think Ellroy is a gold mine. I think he's a wonderful man, and I think he's a great writer. I think The Black Dahlia actually is probably one of my favorite books ever. I think just, really took me away, that story.
So. Did you see the movie?
I haven't seen the movie that they made. It wasn't of his book.
Sure, no. Don't mean Blue Dahlia?
Lucy Arnaz.
No, it wasn't of his book, but The Black Dahlia is a true story, so there's other.
Oh, okay, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's one movie that was made from a James Ellroy book that ended up being a cop, James Woods. Yeah. But it bears no relation whatsoever, really, to the source material.
Had you read him before you got involved in this? Or
I'd read The Black Dahlia, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. I met him in Australia, actually. He was on a book tour.
Really?
And he asked through Curtis if we could get together. So I went and met him at the theater. Like, there's 1,000 people there, and he's just up there talking over the top of this kind of jazz band, and he reads from this book. He's very so cool. He read like about 20 pages, and he stopped and he had a glass of water, and everybody applauded. And he goes, "Oh, come on! I'm going to read you 20 pages and stiff you like that? Sit down!" And he started reading. He's like, he's very cool.
Yeah,
son of Hepcat jazz band.
Yeah.
And he's just rapping over the top of it, And as a singer, he makes a great novelist.
He has a performer element to his personality, doesn't he?
You haven't noticed?
It can.
But the first sentence, how did you know that this was going to be? Well, it came from a great fucking book, and I know it's a great fucking book because I fucking wrote it. That was the very first answer at the press conference, and everyone just went, well, we can relax then.
Do you have much interplay with Danny DeVito, it seems, with him?
Unfortunately, I didn't really get to do much work with Danny because, I beat him up one time, then I stand over his dead body, but we've become great friends.
Really?
Yeah. We spent a bit of time together. I know his family, and he's a good man.
He's got a cop sense of humor. I don't think people realize how he's got a little streak of mischievousness in him.
The funny thing was, last night was the first time he actually saw the film.
Oh.
Even though he's in the theater in Cannes, he left his glasses back in the hotel room, and he goes, we're sitting next to each other, and he goes, "Oh, shit, oh, oh, oh. What's the matter? My glasses. So, last, you know, at the end of the movie, he turns around to me in Cannes and he goes, "You're great." I said, "How the fuck would you know?" But he had his glasses last night, so he saw the film.
This is such a well-crafted film. Is somebody like Dante Spinotti on the set, or does he leave camera operators to actually shoot the stuff?
Forget about it, man. Dante's the man. Yeah. You know, this is the second time I work with Dante because he shot Cooking the Dead. He has the greatest camera crew, a great bunch of guys. He is a hands-on, like, let's do it this way kind of. Goodness, I see it like this. He's got that beautiful kind of cigar-fueled Italian-American accent going on. Like, you know, take the interrogation scene, you know, where it's reflection upon the interior reflection of every character in the room. No, Dante and Curtis have a great working relationship.
But can they drive you nuts setting up?
Absolutely. But, you know, you do things like you go up to, you know, on day five, a three-day shoot of the interrogation room, you know, "Hey, Dante, come on, man. All I got to do is stand in the back of this room here, you know. Come on, what are we doing?" "Oh, Ransom, what I do for you in this scene here, we have the man in the room, the man behind the glass here, and the man behind that. We see through the glass to the people in the room. They inside see their reflection. On the outside, the reflection of the glass are the people in the room. Every man's face etched in the glass like this. They're looking reflection of the man inside from the man outside like this." Okay, mate, will you just give me a call when you need me, all right?
Are there people on a set of any particular film, though, that you will gravitate to? I mean, will it be a cinematographer or a... I don't know. Who is on the set sometimes that an actor can most relate to, if not the director?
It's totally kind of dependent on personalities. I'm not one of those fellas that goes out and immediately learns everybody's name. I kind of like a more organic kind of relationship with people. And you get to know people and you kind of, you gravitate towards them or you don't, you know. And there's no kind of pretension level, you know. But you spend a lot of time with your hair and makeup guys. You spend a lot of time with the continuity woman or man. You spend a lot of time with the props guys, you know. And when I say guys, it's not, let's get this straight out, be politically correct. It's just not like a sexual, like, definition here, you know. But it sounds better than props peoples, okay? And with the cinematographer, it's all kind of like totally dependent on if they involve you. You know, I was watching the film last night, and I just remembered a conversation between me and Dante in the liquor store when Lynn first walks into the liquor store. You know, he was doing this thing where he came around from behind her and saw her face, you know. And I said, "Dante, look, man, you know, when I'm looking at her, I'm looking at everything. I'm starting from the fucking black velvet gloves, and I'm going up her arm, okay? She's like, she's got me, and I'm just looking at it." And he goes, "Oh, that's what I see, see." And so that's what he does. He comes around and he goes down on the gloves and up her arm and finds her face. Sweet as a biscuit. A biscuit in Australia is a cookie. Biscuits here are not sweet. Yeah. But where I come from, they're sweet.
Was Elroy on the set at all?
Elroy visited the set twice. I think one of the cool things about this, and you notice when you talk to James, is there's none of this, you know, I hear like many old stories, like the authors of the source material freaking out, and you didn't use that character, and having this really bad relationship with their director and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think James and Curtis have a great friendship, and James and Brian Helgeland the same. And we're allowed, because of that friendship, great access to Elroy. You know, if ever I had a question about Butter, I could go to the original source. You know?
He's from Winnipeg.
Funny as hell, isn't it?
I appreciate it, but
you're from Toronto, but you live in Winnipeg. Oh, well, you got nothing to complain about then, really.
Well, yeah, but.
And you choose to live there. It's not my fault. It's not his fault. You know. No, but I mean, come on. You got to play to the strong suit, and Canadians are very parochial. So am I. So I just thought, well, I'll try that gag, and that worked. I mean, it would work the same if I did the Australian equivalent, you know. And actually, Kim Johnson, the director of For the Moment, was in the audience last night.
Oh,
yeah, he called me yesterday, and I got him a ticket and stuff like that. So I just thought, well, I'll just you know.
Rupert, sorry, what is the Australian equivalent?
Of Winnipeg?
Of Winnipeg and Toronto.
Oh, man.
Because if you said the same thing in Toronto, actually, everybody in Winnipeg would have died laughing, too.
Yeah. Oh.
I think you would have said, oh, I'm glad to see that there's more to Canada than Toronto, then Winnipeg crowd would have come in.
Yeah. I suppose the equivalent of that experience, because I flew into Winnipeg and then worked in Brand and then flew out of Winnipeg. You know, and when I got back to Australia, people said, where have you been for the last 4 months? I said, I've been in Canada. I said, oh, where'd you go, Vancouver? No, no. Toronto? Montreal? Calgary? Where the fuck did you go, man? Winnipeg. So it's like flying into Wagga Wagga. visiting Broken Hill and then leaving Australia. This is not the true Australian experience, but somebody just turned off. Quick.